Deuteronomy, the fifth book of the Bible, chapter 7. When the Lord your God brings you into the land you are entering to possess, and drives out before you many nations, the Hittites, Girgashites, Amorites, Canaanites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites, seven nations, larger and stronger than you, and when the Lord your God has delivered them over to you and you have defeated them, then you must destroy them totally. Make no treaty with them and show them no mercy. Do not intermarry with them. Do not give your daughters to their sons or take their daughters for your sons, for they will turn your sons away from following me to serve other gods, and the Lord's anger will burn against you and will quickly destroy you. This is what you are to do to them. Break down their altars, smash their sacred stones, cut down their Asherah poles, and burn their idols in the fire. For you are a people holy to the Lord your God. The Lord your God has chosen you out of all the peoples on the face of the earth to be his people, his treasured possession. The Lord did not set his affection on you and choose you because you were more numerous than other peoples, for you were the fewest of all peoples. But it was because the Lord loved you and kept the oath he swore to your forefathers, that he brought you out with a mighty hand and redeemed you from the land of slavery, from the power of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. Know therefore that the Lord your God is God. He is the faithful God, keeping his covenant of love to 1,000 generations of those who love him and keep his commands. But those who hate him, he will repay to their face by destruction. He will not be slow to repay to their face those who hate him. Therefore, take care to follow the commands, decrees, and laws I give you today. If you pay attention to these laws and are careful to follow them, then the Lord your God will keep his covenant of love with you as he swore to your forefathers. He will love you and bless you and increase your numbers. He will bless the fruit of your womb, the crops of your land, your grain, new wine and oil, the calves of your herds and the lambs of your flocks, in the land that he swore to your forefathers to give you. You will be blessed more than any other people. None of your men or women will be childless, nor any of your livestock without young. The Lord will keep you free from every disease. He will not inflict on you the horrible diseases you knew in Egypt, but he will inflict them on all who hate you. You must destroy all the peoples the Lord your God gives over to you. Do not look on them with pity, and do not serve their gods, for that will be a snare to you. You may say to yourselves, "These nations are stronger than we are. How can we drive them out?" But do not be afraid of them. Remember well what the Lord your God did to Pharaoh and to all Egypt. You saw with your own eyes the great trials, the miraculous signs and wonders, the mighty hand and outstretched arm with which the Lord your God brought you out. The Lord your God will do the same to all the peoples you now fear. Moreover, the Lord your God will send the hornet among them until even the survivors who hide from you have perished. Do not be terrified by them. For the Lord your God who is among you is a great and awesome God. The Lord your God will drive out those nations before you little by little. You will not be allowed to eliminate them all at once, or the wild animals will multiply around you. But the Lord your God will deliver them over to you. How odd of God to choose the Jews. That famous couplet was composed by William Ewers, I think, and it expresses very succinctly the bewilderment an awful lot of people feel when they're confronted by what theologians call the doctrine of election. We all know, don't we, that we make choices. We human beings aren't the helpless puppets of fate. We have a power of self-determination. By exercising our free will, we can alter the course of events. We can shape history rather than just be moulded by it. And that power of choice is enormously important to us. It's the reason most of us would rather live in a democracy than a benevolent dictatorship, isn't it? We value our personal liberty. We want the freedom to choose our own government. And in a political context, the word election represents our opportunity to do that. Well, according to the Bible, God, too, elects. He's not just a passive spectator of our human choices. He intervenes in history with choices of his own. Being God, he has certain advantages over us when it comes to choosing. Because he's all-knowing, for instance, God's choices, unlike ours, can never miscarry, never be overtaken by unforeseen circumstances. Because he's all-powerful, God's choices, unlike ours, can never be thwarted. They can never meet opposition which can successfully defeat them. And that's why, at the end of the day, the Bible insists it's God's choices that really count. As the psalmist puts it, the Lord does whatever pleases him in heaven and on the earth. Paul echoes the same conviction in his letter to the Ephesians. God works everything out in conformity with the purpose of his own will, he says. If you think about it, I think you'll see it's difficult to see how God could be God and not exercise that kind of sovereign discretion. To hold otherwise is to suggest the Creator isn't in full control of his own universe. Indeed, carried to its logical conclusion, it would imply that the conflict between good and evil could go either way. Heaven might lose and hell might win if God's choices were as victim to contingency and chance as ours are. But no, the Bible's absolutely adamant such is not the case. God's will may be opposed, but it can't be defeated. God must win. And quite frankly, there would be little comfort in the Bible's assurances about the future if it entertained the faintest shadow of a doubt on that score. Nevertheless, as I say, many people do have problems with this doctrine of election. It's not that we object to the general idea necessarily. People can see well enough how ridiculous it would be to attribute free will to man and deny it to his maker. No, it's the particular use which, according to the Bible, God has made of his power of choice that's the focus of the discontent. It's all summed up, I suppose, by that couplet we quoted at the beginning. How odd of God to choose the Jews. We wouldn't mind God making choices, provided his choices were even-handed and unbiased. But the Bible insists that God has stepped into human history to bestow his blessing in what seems to be a most cliquish and partisan manner. He chose the Jews. How can you possibly admire a God who is victim to such partiality? Any number of problems arise out of this biblical teaching of God's choosing a special people. We can't look at them all this morning, but there are three I'll just outline, because I think our passage Deuteronomy 7 has particular relevance to them. One objection people often have to this whole idea is that it engenders an elitist pride. Maybe you've heard the other little rhyme, "We are God's chosen few, all others will be damned. There's no room in here for you. We can't have heaven crammed." Surely, it said, election is bound to generate that kind of smug superiority in those who consider themselves to be the exclusive recipients of God's favour. Elitist pride. A second complaint is that this kind of teaching engenders a kind of uncertainty and doubt in people, because it implies arbitrariness in God's character. I mean, why the Jews? Why not the Greeks? Why not the Chinese? Come to that, why not the Anglo-Saxons? How can you possibly trust a God who is so capricious and unpredictable in his dealings with human beings as to choose people without reason? How can you ever feel sure in the presence of such a God? And the third complaint that's often made about this whole idea is that it engenders complacency, that it undermines all incentive to effort in spiritual things. If God's going to throw his favours around in this gratuitous and irrational manner, what's the point of trying, they say? It's like sitting one of these new GCSE exams. You sweat and strain over the questions, but the teacher's already made up his mind whether you're a pass or a failure, so what's the point? The only difference is that God's verdict isn't even based on continuous assessment. He, it seems, simply has his class favourites, who are bound to do well. The rest of us may just as well give up. You're either one of his pets or you're not. Well, this morning I want to try to understand this vexed and difficult issue. And Deuteronomy 7 will help us do that. There's no doubt the answers we shall find won't be all that congenial to the 20th century mind, but I do hope at the end we should at least discover that, properly understood, what the Bible has to say about God's choices are neither a ground for pride or uncertainty or complacency among God's people. On the contrary, it is God's choices that actually give the ground, give the meaning to words like humility, and faith, and holiness. And that's why we've called our study this morning, God's Choices, Man's Responsibilities. Let's start then with God's choices, and we'll go straight to the hub of this chapter, Deuteronomy 7, verses 6 to 8, where that choice is very explicitly spelled out. You are a people holy to the Lord your God, says verse 6. The Lord your God has chosen you out of all the peoples on the face of the earth to be his people, his treasured possession. The Lord did not set his affection on you and choose you because you were more numerous than other peoples, for you were the fewest of all peoples. But it was because the Lord loved you and kept the oath he swore to your forefathers that he brought you out with a mighty hand and redeemed you from the land of slavery. Well, there's absolutely no escaping, is there, the scandalous particularism of these verses. By a deliberate act, God has drawn a line straight down through the human race, distinguishing one people from all the other peoples of the earth. He has chosen Israel, doesn't it? He uses three different kinds of vocabulary to describe this choice. He uses the vocabulary of ritual sanctification. You are, he says, a holy people. Holy carries the root idea of ceremonial separation. Israel had been set apart for religious purposes, like a consecrated vessel in the temple. Then he uses the vocabulary of personal ownership. You are, he says, a treasured possession. It carries the idea of a highly valued item of royal property. Israel belonged to God, like the precious stones in his crown belonged to a monarch. But supremely, he uses the vocabulary of intimate relationship, doesn't he? He has set his affection on you. He has loved you. Israel then is not just a thing in God's hands. He did not select her like a carpenter selecting a chisel from his toolbox. No, Israel is his bride, his son, his family, bound to him by the most personal of ties. Now, inevitably, we want to ask why. Any landlord in England who chose his tenants on this sort of ethnic basis would be liable to prosecution under the Race Relations Act. What possible grounds could God have for such a blatant display of discrimination? Well, Moses isn't slow to anticipate that question, and in answering it, he provides us with answers to at least two of those objections to the idea of God's choices that we began by outlining. First of all, in verse 7, he tells us negatively why God did not choose Israel. The Lord did not set his affection on you and choose you because you were more numerous than other peoples, he says, for you were the fewest of all peoples. Now, this is an enormously important observation. See? God's choice of Israel was not made on the basis of any merit or virtue within the nation itself. It wasn't that God was so impressed with her achievements that he decided she deserved some special recognition. Well, on the contrary, the Jews were nothing. A rabble of immigrant slaves, that's all they were. Numerically insignificant, politically impotent, culturally degenerate. God chose them not because of their merits, but in spite of their demerits. And that's a vital insight, you see. Because at a stroke, it excludes that first criticism of the biblical idea of election, namely, that it panders to an elitist pride. Not so. Israel had nothing to be proud of at all. God's choice of her wasn't a compliment. If it was a tribute to anything, it was a tribute to her utter uselessness. And this is, in fact, a general feature of God's choices, according to the Bible. Paul expresses it like this. He says, God chooses the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. He chooses the weak things of the world to shame the strong. He chooses lowly things, despised things, the nothings of the world, to bring to nothing those that claim they're something. And the reason, he says, so that nobody may boast in God's presence. God will have no boasting. He will have no elitist pride. And his choices are designed specifically to make it impossible. See, in a very real sense, it is humiliating to be chosen by God. Because anybody thus chosen knows there was absolutely nothing to commend them to God. For if there had been, he wouldn't have chosen them. Isn't that ironic? That's the first thing we learn then, about God's choices. The second thing, Moses tells us, is positively why God did choose Israel. That's in verse 8. But it was because the Lord loved you, he says, and kept the oath he swore to your forefathers, that he brought you out with a mighty hand and redeemed you from the land of slavery. Now, once again, this is an immensely important verse, because I think it is Moses' answer, really, to that charge of arbitrariness on God's part. But if we were to understand that answer, I think we have to have a very clear idea about the meaning of that word love. It's a word that can easily mislead us these days. For when we speak of love these days, we almost invariably do so, don't we, in the context of erotic relations with the opposite sex. And the trouble with that usage is that it's associated in our minds with a very high degree of unpredictability. They fell in love, we say. The implication being that it happens spontaneously without premeditation or intention. Cupid, we're told, is a very mischievous fellow who fires his arrows at random. And Eros is as a result, a highly arbitrary passion. But that kind of romantic thunderbolt is emphatically not what Moses is talking about here in verse 8 when he uses the word love. When he says the Lord loved you, he doesn't mean the Lord fell in love. Israel's election isn't the result of some emotional spasm on God's part. No, quite the contrary. The love Moses is talking about is not fundamentally an emotional response at all, but a volitional response. Not a passion, a promise. Look again more carefully at verse 8. Why were you chosen? Because the Lord loved you and kept the oath he swore to your forefathers. Those aren't two reasons, the love and the oath. They're one reason. He loved you and kept the oath. See, love in the ancient world, and particularly in Hebrew culture, is extremely closely connected with the thought of loyalty and fidelity. That's why the word love, interestingly, was often used in the ancient world in political as well as marital contexts. We read, for instance, in 1 Kings 5, that Hiram, the king of Tyre, loved King David. By which the writer means that they were political allies, not that they were bosom buddy pals, necessarily. Similarly, it's very common to find the word love used in international treaties, or covenants, as they were called, in the ancient world. One state might well be required, as part of its covenant obligation, to love the sovereign of its partner state. By which was meant not that it should entertain some warm feeling for him, necessarily, but that it should be a loyal, faithful vassal. That was the content of the word love in that kind of context. Now, I think it's extremely likely that this political usage of the verb to love underlies Moses' usage of it here in Deuteronomy 7. Remember what we've been saying in previous weeks, those of you who've been following this series. The whole book of Deuteronomy is structured like a political treaty between God and Israel. It's a covenant document. God is the sovereign, Israel is the vassal state. So when we encounter the vocabulary of love, whilst I'm not suggesting there's no emotional content to the word at all, it's vital to realize the primary thought is that of faithfulness and allegiance within the context of this contract. It's not then the unpredictable and arbitrary romantic love of Cupid's bow that Moses is talking about here when he says the Lord loved you. It's the reliable, promised love of a covenant relationship. That's the love, says Moses, that provides the rationale for God's election of Israel. Why has he chosen you? Because the Lord loved you and was keeping the oath he swore to your forefathers. Know therefore, he says in verse 9, the Lord your God is God, a faithful God, who keeps his covenant of love to a thousand generations. Now again, you see, this is an enormously important insight into the nature of God's choices. We're not to think of a God who whimsically casts his eye across the globe and suddenly decides, oh, I like the look of him or her. I'll choose them. I'll love them. On the contrary, centuries before Israel even existed as a nation, God had called Abraham, her forefather, and given him a promise. Your children will inherit the land of Canaan. And all that Israel had experienced of God's grace and love were a consequence of that ancient oath. He'd brought them out of Egypt, he says, not because he wanted to make them his chosen people, but because in a very real sense, she already was his chosen people. There was nothing arbitrary about God's action at all. It was the very model of consistency. He was keeping his covenant. Now, I know the sharper among you may well be saying, ah, yes, well, that's all very well, Roy. But you see, all you've done is shifted the problem back a few generations. I mean, maybe Israel's election wasn't arbitrary, as you say. It was all because of Abraham. But even if you answer the question, why the Jews, in that way, and say, because of Abraham, you're still left with the question, well, then, why Abraham? Surely God's choice of him was arbitrary. Yet, you know, when you examine the subject of God's choices against the background of the whole Bible, even Abraham's election ceases to be an arbitrary act. For the New Testament insists that God's entire dealings with men and women throughout the ages have in fact been determined by a plan, which God formulated not in the time of Moses, not even in the time of Abraham, but before the universe began. So we find Paul in Ephesians 1 talking about God's people being chosen by him before the creation of the world. So you see, in a very real sense, Abraham was called out of Ur, as the Jews were called out of Egypt, and as Christians are called to faith today. Not because God wants to make them his chosen people, but because in the eternal plan they already are. That's indeed why Jesus can speak of Christian believers as his sheep, who are his sheep even before they hear his voice and respond to him. They don't become his sheep when they respond to his voice. They respond to his voice because they already are his sheep. Now, undoubtedly, there is inscrutability about God's choices. I'm not denying it. If anything, the doctrine of predestination before the foundation of the world is even more mind-blowing than the simple idea of election, isn't it? But if God's choices are inscrutable, they are inscrutable not because there is anything essentially arbitrary about them. They're inscrutable because we do not know the plan. It's a bit like accompanying a person through a maze. He has a map, you don't. At every junction, he makes a decision. To you, it appears utterly arbitrary. Why are you choosing to go that way? There's nothing in the maze to point out that's the right way to go. But he's got the plan. He knows where he's going, and he's making his choices accordingly. God's interventions in our world are similarly consistent. If we want to complain, then we must complain not about the arbitrariness of his decisions, but about the hiddenness of his purpose. That's the real focus of complaint, if there is one. But then, you see, it must be an open question, mustn't it, whether even if he showed us his map, people whose intelligence was as finite and limited as ours could make head or tail of it. Who has understood the mind of the Lord? Asked the prophet. Well, not me, for one. Part of the meaning of faith, according to the Bible, is being willing to trust God even when you don't understand what he's doing. And the Bible insists, trust him you can, precisely because he's never arbitrary. You can trust him because he's utterly consistent. He's always got a purpose. And he's pursuing that purpose with single-minded determination. So if God makes a promise, you can rely on him absolutely to keep that promise, because it's a promise he's undertaken in accordance with his eternal purpose. He'll keep it not just for a month or two, not just for a year or two. Why, says Moses, come back in 1,000 generations. And you'll find he's still keeping that promise. It wasn't an arbitrary whim, you see. It was an oath built into his cosmic plan for the whole universe. He's a faithful God who keeps his covenant of love to 1,000 generations. Love for him is no fickle passion, you see. It's an irrevocable pledge of his will. That's why you can rely on it. That's why this morning, the fact that God chooses does not become a source of uncertainty or anxiety to us. It's the great bedrock of our faith. He knows where he's going. He knows what he's doing. His choices aren't random. He's got a purpose in mind. But that brings us to the second aspect of our study. God's choices. Not on the basis of human merit, but on the basis of his own purpose. Man's responsibility. Do you notice the word but at the beginning of verse 10? But those who hate him, he will repay to their face by destruction. He will not be slow to repay to their face those who hate him. All the difference in the world, you see, between trusting this God who makes choices and presuming upon his choices. Those of you who've been with us in earlier weeks will, I'm sure, remember that in the ancient world, a covenant treaty was always a two-edged document. The sovereign promised to protect the vassal. But the vassal also accepted an obligation in response to that grace to obey the sovereign and remain loyal to him, to love him. And as a result, every ancient covenant contained within it penalty clauses, which would be invoked should the vassal default in that covenant obligation of obedience. It's precisely such penalty clauses God is alluding to here in verse 10. If God is utterly consistent in the fulfillment of his promise, he can also be relied upon to be utterly consistent in the implementation of his threats, says Moses. He will repay to their face those who hate him. True, there are enormous blessings for the chosen people if they keep God's commandments. If you look at verses 13 to 15, you'll see an impressive catalogue of them. Blessings of prosperity and security and fertility and health. But all those blessings, you note, are conditional upon faithful observance of God's commands. If you pay attention to these laws and are careful to follow them, then the Lord your God will keep his covenant of love with you as he swore to your forefathers. He will love you and bless you and increase you. It's vital we don't overlook that if. For it's Moses' answer to that third and final accusation or complaint about God's choices that we talked about. Namely, that they represent an unfair favoritism that undermines all incentive to spiritual and moral effort, that makes people complacent. Not so, says Moses. For there is no partiality with God. He judges everybody with absolute fairness. Jews, included. The covenant he had made with her was no guarantee of immunity from retribution. On the contrary, it placed all the more responsibility on her to be a model nation, and heaped all the more penalty on her if she failed to be such a model nation. And it's against that responsibility that lay upon her as the chosen people, of course, that we must understand this very draconian legislation in verses 1 to 5 of our chapter. When the Lord your God brings you into the land and drives out many nations before you, nations larger and stronger than you, when he's delivered them over to you, you must destroy them totally. Make no treaty with them, show them no mercy, we read. It's easy to be shocked by that kind of passage. Indeed, some perhaps would want to draw some comparison with the kind of holy war or jihad of Muslim fanaticism today. Well, this morning, let me just make three observations about those verses that may help us to treat the passage with rather more respect. The first thing I think we must say is that this exercise of conquest required great faith on Israel's part. Notice the emphasis there is throughout this passage on the fact that these seven nations were stronger and larger than Israel was. In verses 18 and 21, we are told again and again, you mustn't be afraid. Clearly the people were afraid. In verse 22, we're told that God would drive these nations out little by little. For quite obviously, she didn't have the population to occupy the entire land straight away. This then is not the case of a powerful nation looking for some kind of theological excuse for her territorial ambitions. It's a different kind of thing altogether. Israel was pathetically weak, terrified at the thought of being told by God to declare war on what were by comparison superpowers. And if you want a comparison with today, it's a bit like Luxembourg declaring war on the Soviet Union. An act of military folly rather than a fascist imperialism. That's the first thing I think we have to have in mind when we think about what God is talking about here. The second thing we have to remember is that the elimination of these seven nations is quite clearly regarded in the book of Deuteronomy as an act of divine judgment. That comes out very clearly if you just turn over a page in 9, verse 4. After the Lord your God has driven them out before you, do not say to yourself, the Lord has brought me here to take possession of this land because of my righteousness. No! It is on account of the wickedness of these nations that the Lord is going to drive them out for you. The wickedness of these nations. In fact, if you were to look back to Genesis chapter 15, we're told there that the reason Abraham's descendants couldn't take possession of the promised land there and then, centuries before, was because, quote, the sin of the Amorites had not yet reached full measure. It's a clear implication that God had been hugely provoked by the moral corruption of these nations living in Canaan for centuries, and had exercised enormous patience towards them. Now the time had come where his patience was exhausted and he was using Israel to judge her. She was executioner, not pirate. And that, of course, is why there is quite clearly in verse 25 and 26 a commandment that she is to take no plunder. There's to be no enrichment of Israel as a result of this conquest. It's also, of course, the reason why the mandate to conquer is so specific, naming the actual peoples and limiting the mandate to those seven peoples. There is no blanket permission being given here to slaughter anybody who got in her way. She was fulfilling a role of divine judgment against specific national offenders. And in fact, in the Old Testament, war is often used by God to punish nations. All that's happening here is that Israel is being made aware of her instrumentality in that respect before the event. If we're offended by the idea of God pronouncing such sentences against nations, and maybe the thing we really have to ask ourselves is how we will feel when on the last day we see God sentencing men and women to hell. Judgment in the Bible is a serious business. And God has not left us without powerful signs written in the warp and woof of history to just how serious judgment is, and war is one of them. That's the second thing, then, we need to keep in mind when we look at this chapter and maybe find difficulty with it. Israel is acting as a sword in God's hand, a sword of judgment against sinful nations. And the third thing we have to remember, I think, when we look at this chapter is that this whole policy was a necessary cultural hygiene, if I dare to call it that, closely connected with Israel's special role in God's historical purposes. Do you see how that's stressed in verse 6? The key word being that first word, for. You're to do all this, he says to these peoples, because you are a people holy to the Lord. It's precisely because of her election, her chosenness, that this policy had to be adopted. Because a chosen people had to be a different people. That's why God was choosing her. And there can be no doubt that the polytheistic fertility religions of Canaan, appealing as they did to sensuality and superstition, were an immensely powerful temptation to the Israelites to be the same as everybody else. Well, Israel simply couldn't afford that kind of tolerance. It would have been spiritual suicide. She had a special role to fulfill in history. She had to be different. She could never fulfill that role if she wasn't. And this distinctiveness then necessitated the complete elimination of idolatry from within her borders. There could be no compromise with it. Well, enough said. Difficult verses I don't question. But ones, I think, that have powerful spiritual lessons, words that mustn't be run away from. Whatever sense you want to make of verses 1 to 5 and the other verses in chapter 7, it is clear that far from being rendered complacent by her election, the conviction of Moses is that Israel should in fact be rendered more morally and spiritually sensitive than any other nation on earth as a result of the fact that she had been chosen. The standard of purity God expected within her was far higher. The penalties for failure in that purity were far more severe. See, it is no bed of roses being the chosen people. Such privilege brings more responsibility, not less. In every way, then, God's choices, according to Moses, work in the opposite way to the kind of favoritism we were talking about earlier. Instead of breeding pride, it breeds humility because he chooses the worthless and the weak. Instead of breeding uncertainty because of the arbitrariness of his whim, it breeds trust because we're a part of a larger purpose which he's never going to abandon. Instead of breeding complacency, it breeds moral vigor and incentive. Because this blessing of election is only for those who demonstrate that they are different by their conduct. Well, I'm not saying there aren't big intellectual difficulties with election. We haven't discussed an awful lot of the difficulties that you may have in your mind. But Deuteronomy 7 at least provides us with answers to some of those objections people raise, doesn't it? And it leaves us finally this morning with the question, which we've returned to throughout this series of studies in Deuteronomy, namely, what relevance then does Israel's experience in this regard have for us in our nation today? Britain, after all, is not God's chosen people, is she? Even if there have been times in history when she's behaved as if she was. So hasn't all that we've been learning today about election been purely academic? Well, I don't believe it is so. As we've stressed repeatedly, God has never made a covenant with any other nation of the kind he made with Israel. Israel was unique. Yet it must also be faced that for many centuries, this country lived consciously as a nation under God. She modeled herself on Israel. That was how our nation developed. That's how our culture has developed. And in recent years, we have been seeing a steady decay of that Christian heritage. When we were looking at Deuteronomy 5, we observed how moral confusion within Britain today meant that we were departing from the sense of the absoluteness of God's law. Having abandoned our sense of being a nation under God, there was no ethical consensus any longer to which appeal could be made. And so people no longer asked whether a thing was immoral, but only whether it was illegal. In chapter 6 last week, we noticed the change in educational attitudes in our country. How unthinkable it would be these days for pupils within a state school to be actually encouraged to love God and obey the Bible. Though once upon a time, those things most certainly would have been encouraged. For humanism has stripped the religious foundation from under our educational system and left our children in a state of confusion again as a result. Well, I think chapter 7 similarly points up for us things we have as a nation experienced as a result of abandoning our identity as a nation under God. And if I had to express it in a single phrase, I would have to say this. We've lost our sense of destiny. You know, Britain used to have, like Israel, a sense of vocation. There was a purpose to our national existence. We saw ourselves as in the world to be an instrument under God in his purposes. A tiny island, occupied originally by a hodgepodge of warring tribes. Our only source of self-esteem was that God had been gracious to us far beyond our deserts, delivering us from our enemies, shaping our culture according to his word. And he has bestowed blessing, health, and prosperity, which Deuteronomy tells us is only for people who order themselves in that way as a nation under God. Well, Deuteronomy 7 would also tell us that these blessings place a responsibility on us, just as they placed on Israel. The responsibility to be a model of God's standards of righteousness within the international community. Now, please don't misunderstand me. I'm very far from being jingoist. I have no illusions at all about my country. But I do believe it to be an objective fact of history that Great Britain once stood for Christian values in the world and earned the respect of other nations because of that stand. And that stand was the consequence of her sense of vocation. She was a nation under God. Now that our identity has collapsed, a secularizing juggernaut has bulldozed all that to the ground. And in the place of those standards, we see instead the advance of pluralism. Don't we? Pluralism means the acceptance of many different faiths, many different philosophies as equally valid within a society, and no clear national commitment to any one of them. Well, it's precisely that kind of thing which Moses is combating here in Deuteronomy 7. Pluralism is what would have happened to Israel if she hadn't adopted the tough policies she did towards the Hittites and the others. It would have been spiritual suicide for her if she had made alliance with these ideological foes. And I want to suggest to you this morning that it has proved to be spiritual suicide for us to embrace that very same pluralism within our culture. For pluralism destroys any sense of vocation. It undermines all awareness of historical purpose, you see, of destiny. Pluralism casts the culture adrift in a sea without landmarks or stars to guide. Pluralism always spells the death of the cultures it infects. Now again, don't misunderstand me. In no way am I suggesting for one moment that we ought to go about exterminating Hindus and Muslims and Marxists and humanists and so on in some kind of 20th century witch hunt. Britain is not Israel. We have no mandate, such as she was given, to conduct a campaign of violence. It would be morally indefensible. We have no mandate to conduct a holy war against God's enemies. But I do suggest to you, we have a choice. The same choice, in a sense, that confronted Israel. We can either seek to be a nation under God, or we can take our lead from the Hittites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, and model ourselves as a nation without God. A There is no position of neutrality in this matter. There is no sort of possibility of a spiritually non-aligned nation. Our culture, our laws, our national goals, they all of necessity reflect religious and philosophical worldviews. Even if it's only the nihilistic worldview that there is no meaning or purpose in anything. And at the moment, pluralistic confusion is taking our country precisely in that nihilistic direction. There can be no way back for us to become a nation under God once again unless we are prepared to resist the pluralist drift. We all say, well, that's impossible for us. Things have gone too far. We're a multi-faith society now. You can't turn the clock back. The days when Britain saw herself as a nation under God are past. We are a secular pluralist state now. What can't be cured must be endured. Well, maybe so. But if it is so, then Deuteronomy 7 is still not without relevance. Our nation may have lost its sense of vocation. Well, then let's pray most urgently that the church hasn't. It is important to realize that when the New Testament takes these words up in Deuteronomy 7, it applies them no longer to Israel, nor to any earthly nation. It applies them to the church of Jesus Christ. You are a people holy to the Lord your God. The Lord your God has chosen you out of all the peoples on the face of the earth to be his people, his treasured possession. Britain may forget the deliverances of the past, but the Christian cannot. For he has been freed not just from the dominion, the power of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. He's been delivered from the power of sin and the devil, the prince of this world. If you're a Christian this morning, God has chosen you. You have a role in his eternal purpose. You fit in that great plan he had before the world was made. That election is no ground for pride. He chose you because you were weak, not because you were strong. And neither is it any excuse for complacency. For the fact that he has chosen you means you bear more responsibility, not less. In particular, you see, it means we bear the responsibility to be different. To repudiate the pluralist, relativist toleration of sin and error, which the world likes to call being liberal and enlightened these days. And demonstrating instead, as an individual and within the corporate life of the Christian congregation, holiness, separateness, a holiness that befits God's chosen people. And I have to say, of all the disappointments that God must feel when he looks at this country of Britain at the moment, there can be no more bitter disappointment for him than the disappointment he feels with the church. A church which, instead of resisting the secular pluralist bandwagon, has jumped on board it. And it's a pathetic attempt to be trendy and relevant. So we have multi-faith services at Westminster Abbey and homosexual priests at Aldgate. Most serious of all, we have contempt for God's word and public skepticism of fundamental doctrines of his word, not from the world where you would expect it, but from the theologians and bishops of the church, the so-called people of God. Don't we realize who we are? Don't we realize the destiny we carry? You are a people holy to the Lord your God. The Lord your God has chosen you out of all the peoples on the face of the earth to be his people, his treasured possession. be a Christian is to be part of God's elect. Where then is the holiness? Now I tell you, when the church in Britain rediscovers its willingness to be different, when the church in Britain starts swimming against the pluralist tide, when, like Israel, she declares ideological war upon the rivals of God, instead of making feeble alliance with them, then maybe there's hope for our country. Remember what Moses told them. Do not be terrified. The Lord your God who is among you is a great and awesome God. The Lord will drive out those nations before you, little by little. Do not be afraid. Remember well the miraculous signs and wonders, the mighty hand and the outstretched arm with which the Lord your God brought you out. The Lord your God will do the same to all the peoples you now fear. A holy church doesn't have to be a defeatist church. But a secularized church most certainly will be. Tell me now, what do you feel in your heart when you read a verse like, "You are a people holy to the Lord your God. The Lord has chosen you." Do you sense within you that God has given you a role to play amongst his people? Do you feel the Holy Spirit calling you to be different, to make a stand for God in this secular pluralist society we're a part of? I do so hope so. For the future, both of the church and of our nation, hinges on God in his grace restoring to us our sense of election, our sense of chosenness. If we sense within our souls that God is awakening us to a special relationship with himself, weak and sinful as we may be, then there's hope. We are a chosen people. That means we have a purpose in the world. You say, "I do feel that. What must I do? Where must I begin?" Well, you begin with faith. You must trust this God and his purpose. Then you must cross the Jordan. It's called baptism. It is the boundary between the people of God and the world outside. And once you've passed it, why then your battle will begin. Let's pray together.